Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My colleague and co-host Sam Wong is off today. The conservative media and its role in national politics has become an issue of great interest in recent months. Obviously, the relationship between Fox News, for example, and President Trump has brought this story to our attention, and people have been thinking about what the connection is between these two realms. And it's not a story that we haven't heard before. And not only has Fox News been in the press, but there's been discussions of Breitbart and other forms of media in the modern age. The thing is, this is not new, and it has a pretty long history. And the connection between conservatism and a conservative media has also been a story that historians have started to become more interested in. And so today we're fortunate to have Lawrence Jerdam, a historian who specializes in American conservatism, here with us to discuss his new book, Paving the Way for Reagan, The Conservative Press and the Forging of the Reagan Foreign Policy, 1964 to 1980, which is out with the University Press of Kentucky. LJ, as he is called, also has published in the National Review, the New York Times, Newsweek, the Washington Post, and is a well-known commentator on this and many other subjects. So, LJ, welcome to our show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Maybe we could start by just having you give our listeners a synopsis of the book?
Sure. Well, my book discusses three conservative publications. National Review, which was founded by William F. Buckley Jr. in 1955 and was part of what one might call fusionism in regards to conservatism, in that it melded libertarianism as talked about or written about by the conservative pundit Frank Meyer, social conservatism as written about by Russell Kirk, and anti-communism, which essentially fused the whole conservative movement together as sort of discussed and personified by James Burnham. The two other publications are Human Events, which was a very prominent conservative newspaper and represented the ideas of the old right, as I guess one might say is closely personified by Donald Trump, and the neoconservative magazine Commentary, which is still very much with us today and was formerly run by Norman Podhoretz and has now been sort of under the auspices of his son, John Podhoretz. And so I talk about these three publications and how they clarified and crystallized foreign policy themes and ideas from 1964 to 1980 within the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and also how they crystallized and ideas that were discussed frequently and became the foundation of Ronald Reagan's foreign policy before and during his presidency.
And before we get to Reagan and a little more on the specifics of the press, the one wing there that you mentioned that people might not be as familiar with as a concept is the old right. And you said that was similar to Trump, but what was the old right circa the 1950s, 1940s, and 1950s?
Well, the old right was really part of conservatism that was represented by the late Senator Robert Taft. And one could say is perhaps some of, part of it was represented by President Herbert Hoover. And it primarily had within its auspices or under its auspices these ideas that we see frequently today, the ideas of isolationism and the ideas of protectionism. And this type of conservatism within the GOP was quite popular in the 1930s as a response to the New Deal and internationalist ideas of Franklin Roosevelt, but ultimately began to diminish following the conclusion of the Second World War, particularly following the discovery that the Soviet Union had developed the atomic bomb. And once that occurred, all the American conservatism essentially came together under the auspices of anti-communism and became much more interventionist or internationalist in its view of the world and its determination to prevent communism from essentially taking over the world.
Now, today, when we hear of the conservative press, people have a pretty good idea of its scope. Its scale and scope. It's a big institution. So Fox News is not a minor station. Many millions and millions of people watch it, or websites like Breitbart and others, and even magazines such as the Weekly Standard. We have a good feel for what they mean to the consuming public. These different publications, Human Events, or the National Review, how widely read were they when Reagan was really starting to shape his identity? Were these magazines that you could find on newsstands everywhere? Did they have mass subscription bases, or was it more for intellectuals and policymakers?
Well, I think they certainly were available on newsstands, but they were created as a way to influence policymakers. When Weymouth Buckley Jr. created National Review, he created it as an alternative to the mass amount of liberal media that was in existence. He essentially wanted National Review to be what the Nation or the New Republic was during the administration of FDR. Obviously, those two magazines were very, very influential in liberal circles and defined, or rather helped define, much of the policies that FDR and the Democratic Party were advocating. And Buckley wanted to create a magazine that would do the same thing, only for the right. And essentially, that's what it did. And National Review and these other two publications were read by intellectuals. They were looked at very closely by members of the Republican Party, particularly those who were in the Congress and the Senate, and they really essentially steered the narrative for many of the debates that were occurring in American foreign policy during that particular time.
Who was writing the articles? Who were the authors in these kinds of journals? Was it a wide range? Did you have writers who many Americans at the time would know? Were there more fringe writers in some of these magazines? What was the authorship like?
Well, it was a combination. I'd say National Review, as I said at the beginning, had a number of members of the conservative movement within it. Conservatism, as we know, is an ideology that has a lot of different moving parts that are constantly in debate with one another. So you had people like William F. Buckley Jr., who's a well-known figure, and he wrote quite a bit for the magazine. You also had James Burnham and Frank Meyer, two former communists who ended up going to the right at the beginning of the post-war era. They wrote quite frequently for the magazine. For Human Events was an interesting publication in that it was kind of a consortium of different conservative columns that were put in the newspaper every week. There was a lead editorial that was written on the News of the Day, and that was written by a gentleman named Alan Riskind, who was a fellow who Ronald Reagan read quite a bit. His narrative was extremely punchy. It was extremely tabloidish. That's ultimately really what Human Events was. It was a magazine that I think could be most compared to Breitbart. If you recall what Breitbart looks like, it's got those bold headlines at the top and some really strong language within it. And that is essentially what Riskind wrote. He would write every week about one issue or another, be it detente, the Panama Canal, the United Nations, South Africa. And these the newspaper really appealed to the folks who, let's just say, were at the grassroots of conservatism, the people who really ultimately defined, who became the soldiers of the Reagan Revolution. And in terms of commentary, you did have a number of prominent people who essentially became involved in public life during the Reagan administration. You had people like the late ambassador, Jean Kirkpatrick, who wrote a very prominent article in commentary. So if one was interested in conservative ideas or Republican ideas, one read National Review, and were certainly familiar with quite a number of those who wrote for it, but it was not written for the general public. It's not really the same as, I guess, as what we would have as a Fox News or talk radio that exists today, which is essentially much more for general consumption.
And it's interesting to pick up on that you are, many historians who have been writing about conservatism have moved away from ideas a bit. There has been a lot of work on economics and race and grassroots mobilization or the forces of partisanship, but you are bringing ideas back into the mix ultimately and trying to explain where Ronald Reagan came from and the kind of policies that he would ultimately pursue. How did you decide to write a book that placed primacy on the power of ideas in politics?
Well, you know, Dr. Zulzer, as you know, dissertations are group efforts. And when I had begun my degree at Fordham, I had always been a big fan of William F. Buckley Jr. I had enjoyed his columns. I enjoyed his optimism, his ability to look at both sides of an issue. And when he passed away about 10 years ago, I was thinking about what my dissertation would ultimately be. And I found it interesting that for a man who had written so many books, given countless numbers of lectures, written countless numbers of columns, he had obviously been a prominent TV personality on Firing Line. At the time I began thinking about a book about Buckley and the ideas that he had defined, I think there may have been one major biography that had been written on him. And at the time I was discussing the concept with my dissertation advisor, we initially had thought about doing something on the influence of National Review on politicians and on Reagan. And I, in researching that, I realized there was another book that was coming out focusing specifically on National Review. And since I've always been fascinated by power, political power, and how it's achieved and then put into practice, I thought that selecting two other conservative publications, I would be covering, therefore, the entire breadth of conservatism, and I could write about these magazines and how these ideas influenced President Reagan, who really personified so much of what Buckley and these other magazines represented.
And what was that that they represented? So a lot of the work on liberals in at least through the late 1960s focuses on liberal internationalism and liberal hawkishness with, you know, stories such as the missile gap and how Kennedy used that against Nixon and those sorts of narratives. So what, for someone like Ronald Reagan pre-presidency through the 70s, reading Human Events and the National Review and commentary, what would some of the distinct ideas be about foreign policy in that press that really were different than what one was hearing from liberal commentators or politicians in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the most important one was really essentially the, I'm trying to put this into the right phrase, but it was really the complete dismissal and the belief that the policy of detente was not something that, as advocated by President Nixon, was not an idea that essentially created a more stable world, but actually created a more dangerous world. Many believed that detente, essentially, this creating a relaxation of tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union, would make the Soviets more amenable to working with the United States on a broad number of different policies. Those like Buckley and Alan Riskin and Ronald Reagan and many others within the conservative wing believed it would do the complete opposite. And that essentially during the 1970s was the number one issue that Reagan and members of the right rallied against, to the point that during the 1976 presidential primary, when Reagan chose to launch an insurgency campaign against President Ford, the attacks on Ford and detente were so severe, and Ford was getting so criticized by it by members of the right, that ultimately he removed the phrase detente from his vocabulary and instead started using the phrase peace through strength, which was a phrase that Reagan ultimately had been using. So I would really say detente was the major theme that these magazines spent the majority of their time rallying against during that particular period.
So it's interesting that in the 70s, here's this president pre-Watergate, a Republican who is reelected, huge landslide victory in 72. But the conservative press is really unhappy with the foreign policy program that that administration put forward. And even after Watergate, a lot of their ire is still directed toward Ford continuing this with Henry Kissinger and others. And that becomes in some ways a defining focal point, if I read it correctly, for the press that sets up where Reagan will come from.
Oh, yes, very, very much so. And Richard Nixon was someone who was never trusted by members of the right. As Richard Allen, Reagan's foreign policy advisor during the 1970s and later his national security advisor, said to me that Nixon was in fear of the journals of conservative opinion because of the power that they wielded among grassroots Republicans. And Nixon was constantly trying to figure out ways to keep those like Buckley and others within the right who wrote for these journals on his side, because he was constantly concerned that something would happen and then he would really alienate all those conservatives that he desperately needed to keep that Republican coalition together during his administration.
How do you reach through your research the conclusion that by the late 70s, when Reagan's doing his radio addresses, and then in the early part of the administration, the election in the first term, that the press and the ideas in the press were what shaped Reagan, as opposed to other factors that I mentioned a bit? What kinds of sources allow you to make that conclusion? And how, as a historian, do you analyze something like that so that you could make the persuasive case that the ideas really did matter and that the press had an effect?
Well, you know, I spent a great deal of time in a number of collections. It was an interesting project because I was ultimately working on a series of journalists. And when you're in journalism, you are constantly writing on deadline. There's not a lot of time to a lot of these, particularly those folks at Human Events, were not people who kept a great deal of detailed records. They were constantly having to put out their publication and make their point and move on to the next thing. But fortunately, people like William F. Buckley Jr., who were, for whatever reason, concerned with how history would portray him very early on, began to save every piece of documentation that he had, and he decided to deposit all of these up at Yale. And so Buckley and his colleagues kept pretty detailed records about various editorial meetings and what were discussed in them. The other interesting collection, which had just been opened when I started my research, which was Commentary Magazine Collection, which is housed at the Ransom Center at the University of Texas. And that was when I was going through those, and there were a lot of detailed letters between Norman Podhoretz and his authors. But the most interesting collection, and I guess the stuff that really was able allowed me to confirm my thesis, were at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. There is a large amount of material before the Reagan presidency that I happened to find, one of which was a very interesting note scribbled within an article that had been written by the late Richard Pipes, who was an advisor to the National Security Council. And Pipes had written a detailed article about the Soviet Union, Soviet ideology, ultimately what he believed communism wanted to accomplish. And Reagan had read this article. Reagan was a great reader. He was a great reader. He was a great writer. I think that's come out over the last few years since his letters were published, since these radio scripts that you just mentioned were published. And when I was looking at this article that Reagan heavily underlined, there was a very small note that simply said, this is great. I'm really glad he is working with a signed RR. And when you find something like that, it's kind of like a great aha moment. And that was a marvelous moment for me. The other thing that was interesting was that Reagan talked a lot about National Review. He went to as many events that celebrated National Review that he could possibly go to. He praised William F. Buckley Jr. And James Burnham continuously. He had hired members of National Review and Commentary as foreign policy advisors, as domestic policy advisors, as speech writers, because he believed in these ideas. And so hiring people like that really helped him clarify the beliefs and clarify his issues of the day. One of the more interesting points was that many people in the administration didn't like these conservative magazines. They thought that they were a bit radical. They thought that they were conspiratorial. And particularly in examples like Human Events and National Review, they tried to prevent Reagan from going to a number of these celebrations for the magazine. They tried to prevent Reagan from receiving his copy of Human Events. I found a note from one of the appointment secretaries who initially had vetoed the idea of Reagan attending a celebration of National Review, but was subsequently overrided by David Gergen, who wrote a note that simply said, Reagan needs to do this. It will help us with our base. So as you go through documentation, you really do find that these magazines were very important to Reagan as he moved through the early and mid-70s up to the time that he ultimately ran for president. He would crib statements from National Review, or rather Human Events, and put them in his radio broadcasts. He loved these magazines. He enjoyed reading them. He appreciated the knowledge and information that they gave him, and they played a big role in his intellectual development.
And then one of the key moments for Reagan is obviously between 85 and 87 when he embarks on his negotiations with Gorbachev, and it culminates with the INF agreement that limits arms. How does the conservative press respond to President Reagan apparently doing exactly what they were so angry about with Nixon in the 1970s?
Well, they weren't happy about it, and they had no problem saying that. In fact, when I was speaking with Pat Buchanan, Mr. Buchanan recalled that when he was with Reagan at Reykjavik and following the president's meeting with Secretary Gorbachev, Reagan came out, and there was an article that Human Events, I believe, had written, which Buchanan happened to have with him, and Reagan read that article. He got very, very upset. He appreciated these magazines. He appreciated the fact that they had really, in a way, been very enthusiastic about his career. But in the end, Ronald Reagan was far more pragmatic than I believe those on the right are frequently willing to admit. Like someone such as, who we've been speaking about a lot, I believe, in, over the last few days, John McCain, Reagan was willing to go beyond his ideology if he believed he could do something that improved the country. That was very, very important to him, and certainly these magazines were important to him, but he was not a hardcore ideologue to the point that he walked in lockstep with these magazines. And I think that's a very, very important point to make.
And how would you say, in looking back, that the conservative press of the period you studied differed or was similar to the conservative press of our current era?
Well, you know, it is interesting that one could say that following the Reagan presidency, there was, I guess, an embarrassment of riches in a way. When Ronald Reagan was president, you had three magazines that I write about. And as following Reagan's presidency, and as we have seen, the conservative press has now, in a way, become a cottage industry. We have, of course, Fox News. We have the Weekly Standard, as you've mentioned, and the American Conservative. And then, of course, there are all the websites, townhall.com. And then there, of course, is the incredible proliferation of talk radio. So it's become a mass industry. You have the conservative movement itself has become even bigger than what it was, certainly from an intellectual point of view, when it used to be anti-communist, social conservative, and libertarians. We now have what one might call paleo-conservatives, which essentially are those that subscribe to the ideas that Pat Buchanan advocated, and I believe is most similar to the ideas of President Trump. You've got compassionate conservatives. You have the Leave Me Alone conservatives. You have just all of these different groups within the conservative movement, and there seems to be a media or a media element that fits every single one of them.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I can continue this conversation for a while, and it's a really interesting, fascinating book. I hope people pick it up. Again, our guest was Lawrence Jerdam, and the book is Paving the Way for Reagan, The Influence of Conservative Media on U.S. Foreign Policy, and it's now out, available online and in bookstores from the University Press of Kentucky. Really a terrific read. Thanks for joining our show.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.